Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, we stream at the same time we broadcast at prairiepublic.org, and you can always find the show there after we broadcast. And today we're going to start our show with somebody we usually have later in the program, but movies and entertainment have been as disrupted as just about anything in our country, and we're going to talk with Prairie Public's movie expert, and that's Matt Olien, who usually does a movie review for us on Fridays, and today we're going to talk about a broad range of subjects related to the industry. Matt, always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Doug.
Let's talk first about the movies that we won't be seeing premiered.
Well, there's a lot of them, and of course, I do not have a regular film review this week because theaters are closed, and I didn't have a backlog of things to see. So let's talk about the industry and what's going on right now, Doug. COVID is affecting the film industry quite heavily. It's not as well reported out there because I think the general public kind of sometimes views the film industry as sort of a separate industry almost from normal commerce, if you know what I'm driving at, Doug. And I think there's a perception that people in the film industry are rich. Some are, but some are not. And so this is having a big impact on the film industry. With the theaters closed, Doug, I'll go through kind of the movies that have been delayed on their release. The first major movie to really be ahead of the curve, I would say, Doug, was the No Time to Die James Bond people. They made an announcement weeks ago that they had moved their premiere to November, even though the film was ready to go, ready to be released in April. And I remember when they did it, there was some people wondering, I wonder why they're doing this. Theaters are open. But they clearly knew that the China impact was enormous. That's the first thing, because Bond is very big in China. And the second thing is I think they had a feeling that theaters were going to shut down. So that was a pretty smart move by the Bond people. I think that will increase hype for the Bond film when it's ready to go in November. So that was a good move, certainly a financial move by the Bond people. And then following closely after that, Black Widow with Scarlett Johansson, kind of the backstory prequel film of her character, or her Marvel character, was going to premiere, I believe it was May 1st, Doug, and that has been indefinitely put back. We do not have a release date on that like we do for the Bond film. Mulan has been pushed back to an undisclosed release date. Fast and Furious 9 has been pushed back to April of 21. These are films that are done and ready to be shown. The Personal History of David Copperfield, starring Dev Patel, that has been pushed back. Quiet Place 2 with Emily Blunt, that would have been probably the top moneymaker last weekend, Doug, at the box office. But, of course, it didn't open, so that has been pushed back indefinitely as well. There are a lot of films that are sort of locked and loaded, Doug, but they have nowhere to screen right now. And so I think some of these films, and I can get into that list a little bit later, are kind of waiting for their premiere dates and hoping that those premiere dates will be hit.
Well, oftentimes smaller films or independent productions premiere at festivals, and the festival circuit has certainly been disrupted.
So that's another side story of this, Doug, is there are no film festivals going on right now. South by Southwest was the first film festival to cancel. We were pretty close after that. As you know, the Cannes Film Festival has been postponed. They do want to hold that this summer in France, but right now we do not have a date where they're going to have that. They're waiting and watching like all of us. A lot of films were set to premiere at Cannes that are kind of waiting to be seen right now. But the reason the film festival circuit is so important for certain filmmakers, the film festival circuit is not important for Steven Spielberg or Martin Scorsese. It's important to independent filmmakers like our friend Mike Schultz, who lives in Duluth and did such a great job with our Rip List movie last year. Imagine if he'd have had that ready this year. He'd have had no place to show it, basically. So a lot of films right now are waiting. They're not in film festivals. These are people that need their film seen at film festivals. That's how they get distribution deals. That's how they get streaming deals. Our friend Melody Gilbert, who had the documentary Silicone Soul last year, that movie is now on Starz Channel. So she got a deal based on that being shown. But these are filmmakers that are not millionaires. They have other jobs. They make movies because they love them. They want their films out there to be seen, and no one is seeing them right now, and that's a big problem.
And the Fargo Film Festival, of course, was canceled, and you have played a prominent role in the setup of that for years now. Is there any plan to bring it back this year, or is it just off until 2021?
Yeah, so this was a huge disappointment, as you know, Doug, because this was the 20th annual festival, and we had some returning filmmakers coming back to screen movies. We had a Friday afternoon retrospective lined up with Cake and, you know, other filmmakers coming, and so it was a huge disappointment. It's the single biggest moneymaker for the Fargo Theater every year. So I want to remind people that if you love the Fargo Theater, it's closed right now. And this was a huge moneymaker that went away. And so anything people can do to support the arts, support the Fargo Theater when it reopens, yeah, any kind of membership fundraising would be most appreciated. And I will say that this summer, Emily Beck has announced, at least tentatively, that we're going to try to have about a two-day festival in the summer to try to screen the winning films. It won't be a complete lineup. It's going to be scaled down, but that's probably the best we can do right now. And let me also mention, too, Doug, all theaters are closed in the state of North Dakota, so not just the Fargo Theater, but your local theaters in your towns, they need your support. Now more than ever. So I want to put that out there. There's a lot of great theaters out there. Some are mom-and-pop theaters. And I can only imagine the economic hardships they're going through right now. And people that work there. I mean, people that are employed at these theaters.
How about productions of movies? If you've got these kind of worldwide awareness that we shouldn't have more than 10 people within 6 feet of each other at one time, that sort of stops production on a lot of stuff, doesn't it?
It sure does, Doug. Film shoots have a lot of people surrounded in closed quarters. These are location shoots. This isn't like the old days of the 30s and 40s where most movies were shot on sound stages in Los Angeles. We have location shoots going on. Marvel's film, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, that has been delayed on shooting schedule. We don't know when that's going to get going again. The Little Mermaid remake, the live-action remake, that has been delayed. Those are the two big ones that I have noticed. But most film productions are on hold right now. The good news, Doug, is a lot of films are in the can and waiting to be released. Now, Spike Lee's Defy Bloods, which is about some African-American soldiers in Vietnam, his quote is, "It's done, finished, locked, and loaded." So that film is ready to be screened whenever theaters open and wherever film festivals get open. Sofia Coppola's film On the Rocks is pretty much done. I think they're in post-production phase. Steven Spielberg's much-hyped adaptation of West Side Story, they're still going to go for their December release date, although the film is pretty much finished, I am told. David Fincher's movie about Herman Mankiewicz called Mank, that has pretty much been completed and is in various states of post-production. Herman Mankiewicz, as you know, Doug, co-wrote Citizen Kane with Thorson Welles, and his grandson, Ben, is the main host on Turner Classic Movies, so I'm really looking forward to that movie. It's good to see that one is finished. Again, if it wasn't finished, we'd have delayed productions. Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch is locked and loaded. That was going to premiere at Cannes, and I know Wes would still like to premiere that at Cannes in June or July if that gets rescheduled. So those are some of the big ones that are done and kind of ready to go that aren't required to have production going on. So what can happen then, Doug, is, you know, one or two people can sit in an editing room, sanitized, hand sanitizer, everything's clean, and they can work on the post-production of these films, presumably in a safe environment.
And, of course, that still is problematic for people who might want to assemble to see a movie in a theater. As you mentioned, they're all closed now, but that doesn't mean we can't stream online. And I've been doing a lot of that lately.
Yeah. So what's happening now is some of the movies that are in theaters right now, like Emma, which I reviewed, The Invisible Man, which I did not see. I sure wish I could have seen that because I'd been able to review that for you all this week. What's going to happen is those are going to be, if they're not yet, they're going to be soon, on demand. So you still have to pay a fee to watch those. Those are not free streaming. No one's going to put their movie out there free. that just was in theater. So those are two of the big ones right now that are out there. Portrait of a Lady on Fire, I believe, will have the same route as well. But yeah, you can watch a lot of movies that are old movies. I've been doing that as well last week. You know, I was on vacation last week because of the Fargo Film Festival, and I didn't go to the film festival, so I watched a backlog of movies I had not seen.
Well, I've been watching a lot of online streaming, Carnival Row, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and Bosch on Amazon Prime, and I got to say, I haven't binge-watched like that in my life, so that's a change for me. But I also noticed that on Netflix, there was that movie that was mentioned commonly at the Oscars, The Irishman. So major releases are certainly coming to different places.
Yes, they are. And like I said, you're going to have to pay, though, to see Emma and the Invisible Man and things like that. Now, the financial impact on the film industry, we don't know what that's going to be yet. I mean, productions are halted. Money's being lost. The theaters aren't open. We probably won't know, Doug, for about another year out what the financial impact on 2020 has been. 2019 was a great year, as you know. There were great films up for the Oscars like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Parasite, 1917. Right now, we just don't know how many 2020 releases are not even going to happen until 2021. That will affect the awards circuit enormously. And I know that's a minor thing to talk about right now, but the Oscar people are talking about it. What I have read and I've been told is this is a fluid situation in terms of Oscar eligibility, Doug. As you well know, The Irishman and Marriage Story both were primarily Netflix films last year. They did have very, very short theatrical runs to get eligible for Oscars. Typically, the eligibility is 7 days in a theater in Los Angeles, okay, to be eligible. And you have to have three of those days to have paid people coming in to pay, because the theatrical experience the Academy has determined is still important. Now, the Netflix films are eligible for Oscars, but what they might have to do, Doug, especially for documentaries, there's a film called Crypt Camp. It's a documentary about this camp years ago that premiered at Sundance. It was run by hippies, and it was for handicapped people. And it was really the beginning of kind of the rights for the disabled movement. That's a documentary that was seen at Sundance, but it needs to be released and in a theater. And they may relax their standards for a film like that to just go right to streaming. So they're going to have to really play with this and see how liberal they want to be with a theatrical run, especially if theaters are closed till September. I think theaters are going to open. Again, I shouldn't predict. I'm not a medical expert. I sure hope they're open by June, but I don't know, and none of us know that at this point. If theaters are open by June, this is probably going to be a moot point, but if it goes longer than that, they may have to relax their standards as to what is Oscar eligible in terms of a theatrical run. And this may go down too, Doug. If a lot of films get pushed back to 2021, this might be one of the weaker Oscar years ever in terms of quality, just because there's not enough quantity out there to choose from.
Yes, and I know that the Oscars have on a couple of occasions been close to having been canceled. I don't know that they ever have been canceled. And I assume that they wouldn't consider canceling it just because they didn't think the submissions would be strong enough.
I'd be very surprised if that happened. As I said, if theaters can open by June, I think films like A Quiet Place 2 and Black Widow, they will get their releases. It's just going to be more like a summer release. But films like West Side Story, that's set to go for December. I can't see, hopefully this doesn't go on that long, but I don't know. So, no, I doubt if they would cancel the Oscars. Again, that's a very trivial thing to think about right now. But again, there are people in the industry that have to think about those things because they get paid to think about those things.
Well, let's also think about those people who, rely on audiences. Theaters have been affected. Art galleries have been affected. Musical performers have been affected. And, of course, actors in the movies and on TV series have also been affected. Are any of these studios under pressure? I mean, we're hearing about all these other industries that are starting to show real erosion and maybe even potential collapse because of a lack of business. Are any of the principal studios, or for that matter, studios in general, facing a crisis?
So that's a great question. So far, I have not seen any layoffs at major studios, but that's always on the table. If film productions continue to get pushed back farther and farther, that's going to be a real problem for the studios and for the production companies. One thing we have to keep in mind, Doug, as you well know, a lot of people who work in the film industry work from film to film. That's how they get work. And that's who this is probably going to affect the most. Leonardo DiCaprio is not going to be impacted by this. But the person who's a grip on his next film, the person who's a grip or a lighting person or working with cameras or whatever on a production that's just been halted in Prague or Australia or wherever, they're going to be impacted. And those people are kind of like freelance people. They're not necessarily full-time employees. And we've seen that in other industries, Doug, where people that rely on business, like bartenders and waiters and waitresses, those are the people that are going to be impacted. So I'm really looking out for, you know, a fellow I knew named Kak Lee, who works out in Los Angeles, and he works on crews. And I'm on Facebook with him. I should probably check in with him and find out what's going on. He'll probably have all the answers. But, you know, those are the people that I worry about, because this is a living. It is an industry. Yes, it's a glamorous industry, but it's also a lot of hard work. And, you know, the people that only casually pay attention to this probably think it's all they see the Oscars and they think that's the film industry. That's the culmination of a year, but the work that goes into getting there, making a documentary film, making an animated short, a lot of people are required to make these movies, and I just don't know how many of them are working right now.
Well, I just got done binge-watching Bosch, which is a procedural, a police procedural featuring a Michael Connery character he's a well-known novelist who also produces the series. Okay. And so they did 10 episodes for 5 years, the sixth year is about to come out. And in the course of watching all of these episodes, I really got to appreciate the remarkable character actors who are out there who are working because of stuff like this. I mean, a five-year job on an online distributed series is really fundamentally important, but it's great for the audience too, because you see character development that you wouldn't see at the movies in general.
Yeah, so TV shows are going to be significantly impacted. A lot of TV shows that I watch, like Chicago Med and Chicago Fire, I think are pretty much in the can for this year. But if this drags into summer, you're going to start to see the fall lineup be very much affected, especially, as you say, Doug, with online TV series, things like that. And let's not forget about a subject near and dear to your heart, and those are stage actors and actresses.
Yes.
All over this country, no one is going to watch plays right now. I don't care if it's Broadway or if it's in Minnesota. What's the great theater? Is it Chanhassen down in the Twin Cities, Doug?
The Guthrie?
One of them, and the Guthrie and, you know, the Chanhassen Dinner Theater. Nobody's going to watch these because people aren't gathering in large groups or even small groups. Actors aren't working and people aren't seeing these plays.
Well, I was cast in a show at Theater B called The Father. It's a great play by Florian Zeller, a French playwright whose work won him lots of awards. This particular play won a Tony. It's on hiatus. They're still going to produce the play, but can't produce it until people can come to the theater. So you're right. A lot of people are impacted. Let's get back, though, to the sort of what may be happening here in terms of movie theaters and online. Because when I go to the movie theater now, I can be in this Barco lounger watching this big screen with wonderful audio and have popcorn and whatever else I want at a great expense. But now I've been trained to watch stuff at home. So I'm wondering if this isn't another obstacle to the traditional movie theater, you know, getting its business advanced.
That's another great question, and a question we don't know yet. Will people come back to the theaters when they reopen? That's essentially what you're asking, I think.
Yes.
That's the million-dollar question. I think they will, because I do think the theatrical experience still excites a lot of people like myself. But you're right. A lot of people are getting much more comfortable watching something on Netflix or watching something streaming, and they'll wait for it. They won't go to the theaters. if the film is big enough and good enough, people will go. I think Black Widow will have an audience, but this is going to be a great test for a film like Black Widow, Doug, because what people were talking about with Black Widow is, can a female Marvel character carry a Marvel film? Now, we kind of got that question answered last year with Captain Marvel, which did very well. And certainly Marvel fans are invested in Scarlett Johansson as Black Widow. But now that it's pushed back and people are going to have to figure out the what's the new premiere date, is it going to be a time when maybe Black Widow would not have been as successful? Like, what if this comes out in September? That's not a normal time for a Marvel film. So that could hurt a film like Black Widow if people have to find where it is, when's it coming out. Now, the Bond people, as I said, Doug, I think they handled this beautifully because people now know it's going to be the weekend before Thanksgiving. It's locked in. We know that. I think the Bond people were smart to get out in front of this, and I think people now have that in their head that No Time to Die will be November. But for smaller films, that's a great question. Will people come back to the theaters? I think they will. But any way you look at it, 2020 will not be the year 2019 was for the film industry.
So we know the mega movies will always sort of be out there because the major studios want those franchises, the Bonds or the Avengers or whatever. But that smaller film industry that you just referenced, that might be the most vulnerable?
I think it's the most vulnerable, Doug, because people are really going to have to do some work to find out when these films are coming. So maybe a movie was going to be in May that might have been at the Fargo Theater or a smaller independent cinema, and now they're going to have to look for it in July and August. I'm playing a hypothetical game here. I think those are the films that could be hurt. The Bond people are going to make money. I think Black Widow will make money, but I don't think it'll make as much money as it would have in the first weekend of May. So the smaller films, I'm sure, this is a nerve-wracking time for them. They got to find outlets. They got to find theaters. Theaters have to reprogram their films for later dates, and that might bump into, you know, other films trying to find different dates as well. So it's going to be like a traffic jam. That's the big thing, Doug, is it's going to be a traffic jam of films being released because Quiet Place 2, Black Widow, all these films are going to have later release times, and that's going to bump into what would have been released in, say, June or July. So it could really be a traffic jam of movies trying to find theaters.
And we should end where we started, which is there are a lot of people whose lives are disrupted, not just people in the arts, but a lot of people in the arts have other side gigs that actually support their interest in the arts. You know, a lot of actors wait on tables and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And there's a double whammy there because they can't act, they can't wait on tables. So at this time, it's probably appropriate to think about others. You know, some of us are more fortunate than others are, and maybe it's going to take a village to get everybody back on their feet.
And when we generally think of actors and actresses waiting tables, where do we think, Doug? We think New York and L.A., don't we?
Well, it happens here, too.
Right, but you know what I'm saying? That's where a lot of them are, and New York is in the belly of the beast right now, and nobody's waiting tables. I think the California situation, again, I don't want to put on a medical hat, but I think it's getting a little better out there. It's certainly not as bad as New York, but those are people that need jobs for sure.
Well, we always check in with our movie expert on Fridays to get a review, but this week we thought we'd get an extended view of the industry. Matt, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with our news director, Dave Thompson. First, today's news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is among elected leaders questioning President Trump's suggestion that businesses could be reopened by Easter.
I think that is not confirmed by the science. I don't think Dr. Fauci agrees with that.
Walz says he is not alone when he says the president may be playing fast and loose with the facts.
I'm trying to encourage the president, I think many of the governors are, that you can't just go on TV and tell people that you gave out 3 million and 95 masks. That has to be in the context that we need about 300 million. And for some of us, it goes back again. And then at the same press conference, telling governors to to go find it themselves, which of course we're going to do and are doing. So I think I'm just asking for consistency.
Wall says guidance changes are being made by the president and they are often unveiled in press conferences. He says when you bypass the normal channels, such as the CDC, you eliminate any peer review or discussion about the move.
Even though our school will not look or feel the same as it has in the past, our level of commitment to each and every student in this district will not change.
Moorhead School Superintendent Brandon Lunick has released details of the new distance learning plan to be implemented by the district. Lunick says the plan includes the delivery of meals, providing daycare, and an alternative plan for delivering education. Students in grades 5 through 12 have been issued a Chromebook in order to take part. Lunick says area internet providers have also stepped up to ensure all students have an internet connection. Lunick says the plan will go into effect March 30th and will end no earlier than May 30th. He says the current projection is that classes will resume on May 5th.
Power School Learning will be our primary platform for grades 5 through 12 in this distance education plan. This platform is familiar to our students and parents, as we have had it in place for the last 9 years, but students and teachers will be using it in a much expanded capacity.
Lunick says the plan includes building specific approaches with information sent to parents. The plan is also posted in the school's district's websites. And Grand Forks County voters will cast their ballots by mail in the June primary election. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, Governor Burgum gave counties the option to conduct voting by mail instead of having a physical polling place. Today, the Grand Forks County Board unanimously decided that was a good idea. County Auditor and Finance Director Deb Nelson.
I will have a difficult time finding workers to work at polls. The workers that we usually get are over 65 years old. They are in the high-risk group for the COVID-19 pandemic. And then I think our voters are not going to want to go up to the polls.
The board also decided to, during the pandemic, close the county office and courthouse buildings to the public and county employees, except for department heads and key personnel. In addition, Northeast Human Services and state employees on the upper floors of the county building will be able to meet clients at the east door, screen them, and escort them into the building. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, you can tell by that teletype in the background that it's time for our weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson. And Dave, it's a COVID-19 week again.
Is it ever? And we've had a lot of information coming at us from a lot of different directions this week. So, yeah, it is quite intense, let's put it that way.
Well, the big number is the number of cases that's been creeping up, more than just creeping up, I guess. It's alarmingly bigger than it was a week ago.
It is. We're talking 58 cases at last report.
And across the river in Minnesota, the governor of Minnesota has ordered a shelter in place for the entire state. Montana has done the same thing. We're in the middle. Do you think this is coming to us?
Not yet. I believe that the governor, Governor Burgum, wants to try to keep doing with social distancing. He believes that the way we're doing it, he thinks that that curve they talk about can be flattened, and we won't see our medical systems overrun. That may change if we do see a major spike over the next couple of days in cases, but so far things are in the manageable stage.
And he is still doing these daily briefings for everybody, right?
Absolutely. He's doing 7 days a week.
The other issue that I saw that was just filed today by you, of course, is that the state is hoping to go to a vote-by-mail primary in June.
That's right, yes. And not surprising there's been a lot of clamoring from some of the counties, and they worry because the way the law is written, if you do vote-by-mail, you still have to have one precinct where people can go to vote. Now the governor signed an executive order saying that requirement is no longer valid, so counties can do their entire ballot by mail if they want. It is still an option that the counties have to decide by themselves. 33 counties are using vote by mail in North Dakota. That means 20 right now are not using that, but it appears that a lot of them are going to really seriously look at it over the next week or so.
I wonder how this is going to affect turnout. Whether it might be greater just because people will be putting it in the mail.
I think so. That, you know, it's interesting because you'll get it in the mail. You're probably just, you know, trying to keep your social distance. So it might actually be good for a turnout. Still, there's that thing, and I've got to say this, and this is just from my perspective. I like going to a precinct and casting a vote. Well, with COVID-19 right now, not happening.
There is a new child care initiative also in light of COVID-19. You filed that this morning, too.
Right. I think the big things on that, number one, they're going to limit it to 10 children per caregiver. And they want to avoid places like common areas. You know, some of these bigger daycares have several classes, and they're trying to avoid common areas and avoid, you know, cross-mixing of people just to keep the virus out. And if you are with the same with one group of kids, you're going to be with the same group of kids all the time. There could be more hiring because they're limiting to 10 children per person, per instructor or teacher, whatever you want to call. So there's probably going to be some hiring. But some of the things that have come out about daycares are a little bit disturbing. For example, we've lost about 23% of our daycares in North Dakota. And there's a real effort that when the COVID-19 threat passes, they want to get that number back up because businesses are clamoring for daycares.
Well, that and, of course, the current circumstance may require some money, won't it?
It did. And, of course, right now they're saying it's going to cost about $11 million per month to do this. And there's some room in the DHS budget to do that. They've got that covered. Plus, they're expecting, you know, block grants perhaps from this big stimulus package that's going through Congress, and that the block grants may help out too.
You know, everybody's got to be on pins and needles about this particular issue because a child who is positive in a daycare environment will perhaps literally shutter that daycare.
Exactly, because you don't want that to be shared from person to person. And daycare centers, because of the way they're constructed, and we have 10 kids probably in fairly close proximity, there's some concern about that.
And there was a case in Wishick, I think,
that
was
correct.
Under investigation.
Right, and if I remember correctly, the child was under the age of 10. And I believe that is still under investigation. They're doing some contact tracing, too, to see what happened there.
Another big story that broke this week that wasn't necessarily COVID-19 related but certainly rattled the state was that the federal judge ordering the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do a full environmental review of the Dakota Access Pipeline. That really shook the the timbers.
It certainly did shake the timbers and the tempers, as you put it. That's correct. What happens next will be the one – what is Energy Transfer Partners going to do, the Dakota Access Pipeline owners? Are they going to appeal this to a federal appeals court? Is the judge going to say stop the flow of oil while this is being done? And from what – I've not been able to gather a lot of information on this, but I don't think we have seen the last of this in terms of appeals and in terms of how the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is going to be involved in this.
Well, the judge, James Boasberg, said that a lot of questions remain about leak detection, the operator's safety record, the possibility of worst-case spill. All of these were issues that were raised during the protest against DAPL now 3 or so years ago.
That is correct. Energy Transfer Partners were saying that they've got the latest and greatest in terms of leak detection devices, and they've got the latest and greatest in terms of any kind of problems at all with the pipeline. So that I'm sure they may have to go through another couple steps now to prove that. But really, we're talking about compressor stations, and we're talking about a more than doubling of the capacity of the pipeline. So there is some concern.
Okay. Well, on to another issue in the oil patch. The Industrial Commission is reviving the inactive well waiver. What does that mean?
Well, if a well is inactive for a year, then the company either has to bring it back online within the year or plug it. And now the company is saying, hey, we need some flexibility here. With oil prices, you know, below $30 a barrel, they're not making a lot of money from the more marginal wells that are not in the sweet spot of the Bakken. So they're saying we want the flexibility to shut in the well but not have to cap it, and when prices return to where it's economic, then we can ramp up production fairly quickly. And that's, I think, what's behind the Industrial Commission's decision on that. And there wasn't a lot of discussion at the commission meeting. They said that made some common sense to them.
Well, I looked at the benchmark price of West Texas crude earlier today, and it was a bit over $21 a barrel. So the price has plummeted.
That means Bakken crude is about $14 a barrel, I think, right
My
now.
Heavens. That's a long way from 30 or even 50, which I suspect is where that waiver might move aside. Huh?
Right. At $50 a barrel, the waiver goes off, and then go back to the rule which says if you've got an inactive well, either a year from there you have to get it pumping again or you have to reclaim it and cap it.
So we've got all this pressure on shale oil producers, particularly, of course, our Bakken in North Dakota. There's the Saudi and Russia standoff over production, which has really dropped prices precipitously. There's the COVID-19 slowdown of everything. People just aren't going anywhere. I've seen
right.
gas prices I haven't seen in a long, long time.
Exactly, yes.
How about this North Bakken expansion project that's awaiting federal okay? Is that, is that something that will get done in the lull?
It probably will because the application went into FERC before the COVID-19 happened. And this is a natural gas pipeline. Part of it is to collect natural gas and to reduce flaring in the Bakken and get the gas that comes from processing plants to market. And the feeling is that natural gas is going to be around for a long time. Even when oil production may start to decline naturally in the Bakken, it looks like natural gas is going to stay up there for a long, long time. So this is a way to say, okay, when the prices get back, we have a vessel to carry the gas to market.
This is a big pipeline, a 24-inch diameter line.
It is, and it's a $300-plus million project. And it's 61 miles long. So it tells you that is a quite an investment that WBI, which is a subsidiary of MDU Resources Group, is placing into the Bakken. So there's still confidence that the Bakken is going to be around for a while.
And it might help, obviously, reduce natural gas flaring.
Exactly. And that's another thing that they're touting it, saying, hey, we can limit flaring at this point if we get this way to get this gas to market back online.
And in the other news department, Dave, you reported this morning that the North Dakota Board of Higher Education has named presidents for Bismarck State College and Dickinson State University.
That is correct. Dickinson State University, Dr. Stephen Easton, who was appointed the interim, they just took the interim off his title and figured we can do this because he's gone through a search now. And if I can just brief you about this, it used to be that you would name an interim president without going through a search. Well, the Board of Higher Education's new rule says, hey, for an interim president, you have to go through a search. So they said he was named interim president. He's interested in the job. He already went through a search. Why bother a second search? And they just took the interim off his title, and now he's president of Dickinson State.
And there's a new president at Bismarck State to replace Dr. Larry Scogan.
Right, from Rockford, Illinois. He's got a very good resume, and he said he's got some very interesting plans as Bismarck State College transfers into a polytechnic institute, which will actually offer some four-year degrees that are, bachelors of science.
So this is Dr. Douglas Jensen, the next president of Bismarck State College.
Exactly.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
This week on Away With Words, sometimes language takes the long way around.
I had a meal with some friends here in Williamsburg, where I live about half a year, and afterwards observed to them that it was good crack, and they all looked askance at me, thinking I was talking about cocaine.
Join us.
I'm going to tell you how the cow ate the cabbage, and you're not going to like what my answer is.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Sue Kesterman. She's the Executive Director of Churches United in Moorhead. Thanks for joining us, Sue.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
There is this stay-at-home order from the governor of Minnesota, and that, of course, puts, you know, more emphasis on the kind of emergency, this pandemic that we're dealing with here. Let's talk about Churches United. How many people are you currently sheltering?
So between the Micah's Mission location on First Avenue North in Moorhead, which is the location that many people just simply know as Churches United, and the Dorothy Day House in Moorhead, which became a part of Churches United in January of 2019, we currently are sheltering 112 individuals at Micah's Mission and 16 at the Dorothy Day House.
And how does that relate to capacity?
That's at capacity.
So how has Churches United adapted to the pandemic emergency?
Well, we've done a number of things over the past couple of weeks. We closed the community center at Micah's Mission and closed to community services at the Dorothy Day House early last week because we wanted to cut down on the number of people that were moving in and out of the house and out of the Micah's Mission shelter. We've made some changes to the ways that we go about meal service. Here at Micah's Mission, where my office is, we're serving meals in three shifts and sweeping and mopping and sanitizing between each of those shifts so that we limit the number of people who are in the dining room at any one time. At the Dorothy Day House, meals have typically been served family style. That is, you know, a dish is passed from one person to the other. We're no longer doing that. And so staff people are, you know, dishing up with gloved hands onto plates for folks who are guests at the house. We are sanitizing everything in sight and have been for a while. It's very difficult, though, in the shelter setting to practice really meaningful social distancing, and it's impossible to really effectively isolate people from one another.
And I assume visitors are discouraged?
Yeah, we were allowing volunteers at both the Dorothy Day House and Churches United, the Micah's Mission location, to assist with meal preparation and serving, but that will end at 11:59 p.m. on Friday. We will not allow anyone in the building who is not either a current shelter guest or a staff member.
How are you watching for symptoms for your clients and staff?
So we have instituted the same screening questions that they're using at the hospitals and clinics. When team members report to work, whether that is someone in an administrative function like me or a more direct service person, we take our temperature as soon as we get in the building, log that. We are adding, taking the temperature of folks who are new intakes to the shelter in addition to those screening questions. Beginning Friday night, Saturday morning, anytime anyone leaves the shelter for a medical appointment or for work or for some other essential reason, they will have their temperature taken when they return before being allowed back into the shelter.
It's probably a big challenge, but how can you handle or mitigate social distancing? Do you have a 6-foot rule or anything like that?
I wish we could enforce a 6-foot rule. You know, with dorm sleeping for our men and our women and family rooms for our families who are here at the shelter, that's just really impossible to do. We have instituted head-to-toe sleeping in the dorms to try to increase that distance as much as we can. We've added extra hand sanitizing stations. We're encouraging people to wash their hands even more frequently than we usually do. We have a spray sanitizer that we're spraying down all surfaces with on a regular basis. We're just doing everything we possibly can. If we have someone here who isn't feeling well, we're encouraging them to wear a mask. If someone is showing symptoms that might be consistent with this virus, we're referring them to family health care for follow-up and testing.
Pastor Sue Kesterman is Executive Director of Churches United. We're talking about the pandemic response for a place that shelters people. So how would you gauge the morale of staff and clients at this point? Is there apprehension, fear?
You know, I think there's some anxiety on everybody's part, right? These are anxious times in which we exist. Everyone is a little anxious. The experience of homelessness is an anxiety-producing situation in and of itself. But we have just an incredible team of staff people at Churches United who work in our various sites. And we're all just doing everything that we can to pay attention to each other, take care of each other, do the best we can to support one another through this.
The 21st century has seen a run of medical issues here. We've had bird flu scare, H1N1, SARS, MERS, and now COVID-19. So most facilities like yours have some kind of a preparedness manual, if you will. Where are you on the pandemic preparedness process?
Well, we work very closely with Clay County Public Health and the Minnesota Department of Health to give us guidance from day to day. There are some things that are just kind of a part of our hygiene and health practices every day, no matter what's going on. But we're taking extra care and extra guidance from those folks that are specific to this virus.
What about the potential for positive cases in your midst?
So what we are doing is we're working together with the public health authority. That aspect of things is clearly a public health matter and not so much a shelter administration matter. And so there is a plan in place, and I would encourage you to reach out to public health for the details of that to ensure that folks who are homeless are not in a congregate setting, that there have been arrangements made so that they can self-isolate and be quarantined if necessary until they're able to return to the shelter.
What about the loss of income during this emergency?
We have been hit very, very hard by the lack of volunteers. So we're very heavily reliant on volunteer support, particularly for meal preparation and meal service. That's hitting us pretty hard. We're having to hire some temporary employees to assist with food service and meal preparation because clearly people have to eat. We are also aware that, you know, the whole community has been impacted economically and is being impacted economically by this pandemic and its repercussions. We not only operate the shelters, but we also operate the Dorothy Day food pantries. We've already seen an increase in demand for emergency food baskets from folks who've never accessed a food pantry before. And so we anticipate that those in our community who are struggling with poverty and homelessness will be more greatly impacted by this as the economic repercussions play out.
The arc of the pandemic infections is picking up still, and there is obviously the potential that critical personnel at Churches United might become infected. What happens if that's the case?
It depends, I think, to some degree on how deeply we are impacted. We are already very thinly staffed, and with fewer volunteers, we've had to divert team members from their regular duties to things that might not normally be in their job description, you know, the proverbial other duties as required. We are hiring some temporary positions to help deepen our bench and get us through this. If we end up at some point with 25 to 30% of our total workforce out, either because they are ill or they are caring for a family member who is ill, or they have been recommended to self-isolate, we're going to have to reach out in some way to the government, I think, to assist us with getting more people on the ground here. Otherwise, we would have to close that 25 to 30% of the workforce out. If we get beyond that point, we will not be able to continue operations in a way that is safe or dignified. Hopefully, we won't get there.
That's what we'll all hope. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Sue Kesterman, Executive Director of Churches United. More Main Street in a moment.
March is National Nutrition Month. This year, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics encourages everyone to eat right, bite by bite. Nutrition doesn't have to be overwhelming. Small changes can have a cumulative effect. Some ways to get started include eating a variety of nutritious foods every day, planning your meals each week, creating tasty meals at home, and consulting a registered dietitian nutritionist. To learn more, visit eatright.org and follow hashtag National Nutrition Month. A public service message from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 27th. A frightened girl, perhaps suffering from an overactive imagination, leaped from a moving train near Gladstone, North Dakota on this date in 1924. The girl believed another passenger had been watching her and feared the man intended her harm. The girl retired to her berth and jumped from the compartment's window to the snow below. 2 days later, a Northern Pacific employee spotted the girl in a snowbank alongside the tracks. The man halted the train and discovered the 20-year-old frozen and only partially conscious. The trainmen were perplexed by the girl's mysterious appearance, but rushed her to the Dickinson Hospital. After treatment, the girl was questioned by authorities, but at first refused to disclose her name or where she came from. Finally, it was discovered that she was Harriet Merritt, originally from Covington, Kentucky. Miss Merritt was on her way home after working in Seattle, Washington. The authorities were led to believe the girl had jumped from the train in a suicide attempt, but Miss Merritt quickly protested. She maintained that a man on the train had been eyeing her all evening, and she was afraid to remain aboard. Acting quickly, she used the hammock in her sleeper to create a makeshift rope and used this to slide from the train's window onto the snow along the tracks. She reported that she had wandered all night on the prairie, slept in a straw stack, and then returned toward the railroad in the morning. Relatives of Harriet Merritt were notified in Covington, and they subsequently made plans to retrieve the girl. Nurses attending her described her as very imaginative, but many wondered how she had escaped from the incident alive. She'd been wearing only a skirt, stockings, shoes, and a sweater when found on the frozen prairie. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jamie Job. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The coronavirus is in all 50 states now, creating a new reality for all of us, including the best-selling novelist Terry McMillan, who says she misses meeting her fans at readings.
What I really love is when they squeeze my hand or hug me.
The author on her latest novel and the latest on the pandemic, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, the month of March saw the acceleration of the COVID-19 pandemic. So on Monday, we'll hold our March Journalist Roundtable with News Director Dave Thompson. He's a regular. And our featured guest journalists will include Renee Jean, Assistant Managing Editor of the Williston Herald, and Matt Von Panon, Editor of the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.